You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 28th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. War in Gaza. Israel-Hamas extends ceasefire by 2 days. 11 women, children, our latest hostages released. By Tia Goldenberg, Jack Jeffrey, and Sammy Magdy. Suncor Refinery. Probe finds cause of fire. Federal investigation pinpoints vapor leak. 2 workers injured. Refinery was shut down. By Noel Phillips. Environment. A ski wax conundrum. Some waxes contain toxic forever chemicals. Utah town has banned use. By Elise Schmelzer. Insurrection Act. Trump hints at expanded role for the military within the U.S. By Gary Fields. And following up with miscellaneous articles. War in Gaza. Israel, Hamas extend ceasefire by 2 days. 11 women, children, our latest hostages released. By Tia Goldenberg, Jack Jeffrey, and Sammy Magdy. The Associated Press, Tel Aviv, Israel. Israel and Hamas agreed to extend their ceasefire for 2 more days past Monday, raising the prospect of further exchanges of militant-held hostages for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel and a longer halt to their deadliest and most destructive war. 11 Israeli women and children freed by Hamas entered Israel Monday night after more than 7 weeks in captivity in Gaza in the fourth swap under the original 4-day truce, which began Friday and was due to run out. 33 Palestinian prisoners released by Israel arrived early Tuesday in East Jerusalem and the West Bank town of Ramallah. The prisoners were greeted by loud cheers as their bus made their way through the streets of Ramallah. The deal for 2 additional days of ceasefire, announced by Qatar, raised hopes for further extensions, which also allow more aid into Gaza. Conditions there have remained dire for 2.3 million Palestinians, battered by weeks of Israeli bombardment and a ground offensive that have driven 3/4 of the population from their homes. Israel had said it would extend the ceasefire by 1 day for every 10 additional hostages released. After the announcement by Qatar, a key mediator in the conflict, along with the United States and Egypt, Hamas confirmed it had agreed to a 2-day extension under the same terms. But Israel says it remains committed to crushing Hamas's military capabilities and ending its 16-year rule over Gaza after its October 7th attack into southern Israel. That would likely mean expanding a ground offensive from devastated northern Gaza to the south. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. Monday's releases bring to 51 the number of Israelis freed under the truce, along with 19 hostages of other nationalities. So far, 150 Palestinians have been released from Israeli prisons. After weeks of national trauma over the roughly 240 people abducted by Hamas and others, scenes of the women and children reuniting with families have rallied Israelis behind calls to return those who remain in captivity. "We can get all hostages back home. We have to keep pushing," two relatives of Abigail Eden, a 4-year-old girl and dual Israeli-American citizen who was released Sunday, said in a statement. Hamas and others could still be holding up to 175 hostages, enough to potentially extend the ceasefire for 2.5 weeks. But those include a number of soldiers, and Hamas is likely to make much greater demands for their release. The newly released hostages included 3 women and 9 children, including 3-year-old twin girls and their mother, from the kibbutz near Oz, a community near Gaza that was hard hit in Hamas's October 7th attack. The kibbutz said 49 of its residents remain in captivity, including the father of the twins. The Israeli military said late Monday that the hostages were undergoing initial medical checks in Israel before being reunited with their families. Most of the hostages freed so far have appeared to be physically well, but 84-year-old Elma Avraham, released Sunday, was airlifted to Israel's Soroka Medical Center in life-threatening condition because of inadequate care, the hospital said. Avraham's daughter, Tali Amano, said her mother was hours from death when she was brought to the hospital. Avraham is currently sedated and has a breathing tube. But Amano said she told her of a new great-grandchild who was born while she was in captivity. Avraham suffered from several chronic conditions that required regular medications, but was stable before she was kidnapped, Amano said Monday. So far, 19 people of other nationalities have been freed during the truce, mostly Thai nationals. Many Thais work in Israel, largely as farm laborers. France said three of the hostages released Monday were French-Israeli dual citizens, two 12-year-olds and one 16-year-old. The French government is working tirelessly to free five other French citizens held hostage, the French foreign ministry said in a statement. The Palestinian prisoners released so far have been mostly teenagers accused of throwing stones and firebombs during confrontations with Israeli forces or of less serious offenses. But some were convicted in alleged attempts to carry out stabbings, bombings, and shootings. Many Palestinians view prisoners held by Israel, including those implicated in attacks, as heroes resisting occupation. In Washington, White House National Security Council spokesman John Kirby welcomed the extension of the truce. "We would, of course, hope to see the pause extended further, and that will depend upon Hamas continuing to release hostages," Kirby told reporters. More than 13,300 Palestinians have been killed since the war began, roughly two-thirds of them women and minors, according to the health ministry in Hamas-ruled Gaza, which does not differentiate between civilians and combatants. More than 1,200 people have been killed on the Israeli side, mostly civilians killed in the initial attack. At least 77 soldiers have been killed in Israel's ground offensive. The calm from the truce allowed glimpses of the destruction wreaked by weeks of Israeli bombardment that leveled entire neighborhoods. Footage showed a complex of several dozen multi-story residential buildings that had been pummeled into the landscape of wreckage in the northern town of Beit Hanun. Nearly every building was destroyed or severely damaged, some reduced to concrete frames half slumped over. At a nearby UN school, the buildings were intact but partially burned and riddled with holes. The UN says the truce made it possible to scale up the delivery of food, water, and medicine to the largest volume since the start of the war. But the 160 to 200 trucks a day is still less than half what Gaza was importing before the fighting, even as humanitarian needs have soared. Suncor Refinery. Probe finds cause of fire. Federal investigation pinpoints vapor leak. Two workers injured. Refinery was shut down. By Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. The Christmas Eve fire that injured two workers at Suncor Energy's Commerce City refinery began when a vapor cloud leaked from an unused pump valve and exploded as the facility was being shut down after extreme cold caused equipment failures, according to a federal investigation. The vapor was released from a pump that was not functional and had not been used or properly inspected in 7 years, according to the report detailing the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration's investigation into the accident. The fire burned for 6 hours. The report, obtained by the Denver Post through a federal Freedom of Information Act request, said the likelihood of injury had been higher because employees were exposed to the hazards for nearly 7 years without the equipment being inspected properly. Suncor was fined $15,625, the maximum allowed, in June for a serious violation of federal safety standards in connection with the fire at Colorado's only oil refinery. Most of the 1,090-page report was redacted, but it still revealed some new information about the circumstances surrounding the December 24th fire that burned one person's face so badly that he was hospitalized. A second worker was injured but did not need hospitalization, according to the report. OSHA officials could not be reached to explain why so much of the investigative report was withheld from the public. Efforts to reach Suncor officials about the report also were unsuccessful. The report raises questions about how Suncor manages its inspection of dead legs, an industry term for pipes that are no longer used and are shut off from liquids and vapors. The explosion took place after a cold front rolled into the region, causing an extreme and fast temperature drop on the afternoon of December 21st. The deep freeze caused extensive problems, and Suncor officials over the course of about a week shut down the refinery. The Commerce City facility remained closed until early April while it was being repaired, fueling a more than 50% jump in gas prices in Colorado. The cause of the shutdown was shrouded in secrecy, with Suncor revealing little information about what had happened. Since then, details have been emerging in bits and pieces. At a November 16th meeting of the Air Quality Control Commission, state air regulators gave a briefing on Suncor's operations and their efforts to enforce environmental regulations at the refinery. That briefing included an update on the December shutdown, which remains under investigation by the state's Air Pollution Control Division. The extreme weather caused instruments to freeze, and the refinery was unable to make steam, said Shannon McMillan, who manages the Air Division's compliance and enforcement program. Other equipment also needed to be shut off because of freezing and thawing issues. There were also two people that were injured during the initial days of the shutdown, which obviously further elevated the concerns about what was going on, McMillan said. However, her division does not investigate injury accidents. Instead, the Air Division is looking into air pollution violations that occurred during the shutdown. The refinery exceeded the amount of hydrogen sulfide, sulfur dioxide, and visible emissions allowed under its air permits and exceeded the benzene limits allowed in its water permit. That investigation is ongoing, McMillan said. The Suncor refinery has more than 200,000 flanges and valves that require inspection, according to the Air Division's briefing. Suncor gave OSHA a copy of its dead leg inspection program, but it was redacted in the copy of the report provided to the Post. John Chichira, a Colorado School of Mines professor in the Chemical and Biological Engineering Department, described a dead leg as being like a garden hose that is turned off at the spigot and has a valve closed on the nozzle. If it gets water in it and there's a deep freeze, it freezes and expands, Chichira said. You don't really know it until it thaws out. The report shows the pump that exploded was a backup and rarely used, Chichira said. It would make sense for the refinery to have a system of backups in place so that operations would not be interrupted if one failed. Chichira, who reviewed the OSHA report for the Post, said too much information was blacked out to determine whether there were oversights that led to the explosion or what Suncor could have done to prevent the accident. Environment, a ski wax conundrum. Some waxes contain toxic forever chemicals. Utah Town has banned use, by Lee Schmelzer, the Denver Post. Temperatures are dropping, snow is falling, and skiers are waxing their skis for another season, gliding down Colorado's iconic mountains. Those waxes, however, may be toxic. Some ski waxes contain per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, a label for thousands of types of manufactured chemicals that do not break down in the environment. As that toxic wax glides along the snow, it slowly flakes off. As the snow melts into water, it carries the tiny deposits down into Colorado's water supplies. Humans who are exposed to PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, are at risk when the substances build up in the body. They can cause decreased fertility, increased risk of some cancers, and suppressed immunity. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has focused more intently on ski waxes in recent years, though little has happened on the state or local levels to address the toxic waxes in Colorado, Home to 28 downhill ski resorts and even more Nordic centers that millions of skiers visit every year. This is a classic micropollution problem. On an individual basis, it's small, said Peter Arlene, founder of a Carbondale-based company called Mountain Flow that sells non-toxic, plant-based ski waxes. This is invisible, but it adds up. Many industries use PFAS to keep things from sticking. Chemicals are applied to cooking pans to create a non-stick surface, to furniture to help them resist stains, and to skis so that they glide easier and faster across snow. The EPA has banned the production or importation of new fluoro ski waxes, but already existing fluorinated waxes can still be sold and purchased. Fluorinated ski waxes often are expensive and are generally reserved for ski racing. In 2020, ski wax company Swix Sports settled alleged violations for importing ski waxes with PFAS that violated the Toxic Substances Control Act. In 2021, a different company, Taser, settled alleged violations for also importing ski waxes with PFAS. Review of the risks from PFAS in ski waxes is particularly important, the EPA said in an alert, given the potential exposure for ski wax technicians and skiers who apply their own wax. Additionally, PFAS may enter the environment from the use of wax skis and from the ski wax shavings scraped off during application. Colorado lawmakers in 2022 banned the sale of an array of products to which PFAS were added, including rugs, food packaging, and cosmetics, but did not address ski waxes. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment has not investigated how PFAS from ski wax might be affecting the state's water, but a department spokeswoman said the agency was aware that some waxes contain forever chemicals. The Water Quality Control Division has been laser-focused on monitoring for and mitigating PFAS in drinking water. Because we know when drinking water is contaminated with PFAS, it could be a significant source of exposure, spokeswoman Caitlin Beekman said in an email. If any communities have concerns about the presence of PFAS in their drinking water, the division has resources, including grants, to help them with further testing to identify any potential contamination. No bans in Colorado. While neither local governments nor resorts in Colorado ski country have banned the use of fluoro waxes, at least one Rocky Mountain ski town has outlawed the products. Park City, Utah, in March, banned the use or sale of fluorinated ski wax after connecting PFAS in its water supply to a cross-country ski area that is directly above an aquifer, said Michelle DeHane, the city's water quality and treatment manager. Further testing in the spring matched the chemicals found in the water to those tested at the ski country race start line, as well as near the lifts at the resort. This is impacting our drinking water and our environment broadly, she said. It doesn't go away. We don't want the concentration to get worse or for it to hit another water source. Enforcing the ban is difficult, DeHane said. The city has focused its efforts on public education. Officials have encouraged people in ski shops to turn in any fluorinated ski wax sitting on shelves. Since last winter, they've collected more than 600 pounds of wax, which must be incinerated by a contracted company. Being a small town, the community has responded well, she said. The ski competition community has begun to ban fluorocarbon waxes, though enforcement has proved tricky there too. The International Ski and Snowboard Federation multiple times has postponed the implementation of a ban on the substance because testing whether athletes are using banned waxes is slow and expensive. The Federation, which oversees the highest level of alpine sport competition, finally banned fluoro waxes for the 2023-24 season. It will randomly test for the substance. In Colorado, Summit County officials are aware of Park City's initiative, but have no plan to follow suit, said Sarah Wilkinson, a county spokeswoman. The county will test for PFAS when there is a concern, she said. But there have been voluntary changes. Arapaho Basin years ago swapped to a biodegradable ski wax, Pearl, and recently added Mountain Flow wax to its shop, said Mike Nathan, the sustainability manager at the ski area. Arapaho Basin will start a take-back program this winter in which people can drop off any fluoro wax they have and receive a free wax from the shop. It might be tough for us to ban it or know what people have on the bottom of their skis and snowboard, Nathan said. We'll certainly be hoping to motivate people. Alternative wax options. As the ski world moves away from fluorinated waxes, companies are producing waxes that are better for the environment. In 2019, Carbondale-based Mountain Flow began selling plant-based, fluoro-free ski wax. Arlene, the founder, worked in the ski industry for more than 20 years, including years spent waxing skis in a shop's small back room. The more I learned about it, the more I became passionate about something that was better for the planet, he said. People who have applied fluorinated waxes to skis, a process that includes melting the wax and releasing vapors, are most at risk of experiencing harmful health effects. The chemicals can build up in their bodies, increasing the risk for cardiovascular disease, liver damage, cancer, and hormonal problems. Studies conducted in Norway and Sweden found that wax technicians working for World Cup ski teams had blood levels of some chemicals that were up to 45 times higher than the general population. But as the industry shifts, Arlene has concerns about the waxes that will replace fluoro versions. Most are still petroleum-based products, he said, which carry their own ecological impacts. For the most part, we don't know what's in the wax, and we don't know what they're using instead of fluoro. It could be good or it could be worse, he said. Insurrection Act. Trump hints at expanded role for the military within the U.S. by Gary Fields, the Associated Press, Washington. Campaigning in Iowa this year, Donald Trump said he was prevented during his presidency from using the military to quell violence in primarily Democratic cities and states. Calling New York City and Chicago crime dens, the frontrunner for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination told his audience, "The next time, I'm not waiting. One of the things I did was let them run it, and we're going to show how bad a job they do," he said. "Well, we did that. We don't have to wait any longer." Trump has not spelled out precisely how he might use the military during a second term, although he and his advisors have suggested they would have wide latitude to call up units. While deploying the military regularly within the country's borders could be a departure from tradition, the former president already has signaled an aggressive agenda if he wins, from mass deportations to travel bans imposed on certain Muslim-majority countries. A law first crafted in the nation's infancy would give Trump, as commander-in-chief, almost unfettered power to do so, military and legal experts said in a series of interviews. The Insurrection Act allows presidents to call on reserve or active-duty military units to respond to unrest in the states, an authority that is not reviewable by the courts. One of the few guardrails merely requires the president to request that the participants disperse. The principal constraint on the president's use of the Insurrection Act is basically political, that presidents don't want to be the guy who sent tanks rolling down Main Street, said Joseph Nunn, a national security expert with the Brennan Center for Justice. There's not much really in the law to stay the president's hand. A spokesman for Trump's campaign did not respond to multiple requests for comment about what authority Trump might use to pursue his plans. Congress passed the act in 1792, just 4 years after the Constitution was ratified. Nunn said it's an amalgamation of different statutes enacted between then and the 1870s, a time when there was little in the way of local law enforcement. It is a law that in many ways was created for a country that doesn't exist anymore, he said. It also is one of the most substantial exceptions to the Posse Comitatus Act, which generally prohibits using the military for law enforcement purposes. Trump has spoken openly about his plans should he win the presidency, including using the military at the border and in cities struggling with violent crime. His plans also have included using the military against foreign drug cartels, a view echoed by other Republican primary candidates such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley, the former UN ambassador and South Carolina governor. The threats have raised concerns about the meaning of military oaths, presidential power, and who Trump could appoint to support his approach. Trump already has suggested he might bring back retired Army Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who served briefly as Trump's National Security Advisor and twice pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI during its Russia influence probe before being pardoned by Trump. Flynn suggested in the aftermath of the 2020 election that Trump could seize voting machines and order the military in some states to help rerun the election. Attempts to invoke the Insurrection Act and the use of military for domestic policing would likely elicit pushback from the Pentagon, where the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is General Charles Q. Brown. He was one of the 8 members of the Joint Chiefs who signed a memo to military personnel in the aftermath of the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The memo emphasized the oaths they took and called the events of that day, which were intended to stop certification of Democrat Joe Biden's victory over Trump, sedition and insurrection. Trump and his party nevertheless retained wide support among those who have served in the military. AP VoteCast, an in-depth survey of more than 94,000 voters nationwide, showed that 59% of U.S. military veterans voted for Trump in the 2020 presidential election. In the 2022 midterms, 57% of military veterans supported Republican candidates. Presidents have issued a total of 40 proclamations invoking the law, some of those done multiple times for the same crisis, Nunn said. Lyndon Johnson invoked it 3 times in Baltimore, Chicago, and Washington in response to the unrest in cities after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. During the Civil Rights era, Presidents Johnson, John F. Kennedy, and Dwight Eisenhower used the law to protect activists and students desegregating schools. Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to Little Rock, Arkansas, to protect black students integrating Central High School after that state's governor activated the National Guard to keep the students out. George H.W. Bush was the last president to use the Insurrection Act, a response to riots in Los Angeles in 1992 after the acquittal of the white police officers who beat black motorist Rodney King in an incident that was videotaped. Repeated attempts to invoke the act in a new Trump presidency could put pressure on military leaders who could face consequences for their actions, even if done at the direction of the president. Michael O'Hanlon, director of research in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution think tank, said the question is whether the military is being imaginative enough with the scenarios it has been presenting to future officers. Ambiguity, especially when force is involved, is not something military personnel are comfortable with, he said. There are a lot of institutional checks and balances in our country that are pretty well developed legally, and it'll make it hard for a president to just do something randomly out of the blue, said O'Hanlon, who specializes in U.S. defense strategy and the use of military force. But Trump is good at developing a semi-logical train of thought that might lead to a place where there's enough mayhem, there's enough violence and legal murkiness to call in the military. Democratic Representative Pat Ryan of New York, the first graduate of the U.S. Military Academy to represent the congressional district that includes West Point, said he took the oath 3 times while he was at school and additional times during his military career. He said there was extensive classroom focus on an officer's responsibilities to the Constitution and the people under his or her command. They really hammer into us the seriousness of the oath and who it was to and who it wasn't to, he said. Ryan said he thought it was universally understood, but January 6 was deeply disturbing and a wake-up call for me. Several veterans and active duty military personnel were charged with crimes in connection with the assault. Aurora. Last trial over McLean's death spotlights paramedics' role by Colleen Slevin and Matthew Brown, The Associated Press, Denver. The final trial over the 2019 death of Elijah McLean after he was stopped by police in Aurora is expected to delve into largely uncharted legal territory, with paramedics, not officers, being prosecuted this time. Starting Monday, jurors will be chosen to decide if the paramedics committed a crime when they gave the 23-year-old black man an overdose of the powerful sedative ketamine after he was forcibly restrained by police. McLean went into cardiac arrest on his way to the hospital and was pronounced dead 3 days later. Three officers already have gone to trial and two were acquitted. The case will be the first of several recent criminal charges against medical first responders to reach trial and could set the bar for prosecutors in future cases, said Douglas Wolfberg, a former emergency medicine instructor and founding partner of a Pennsylvania law firm representing emergency medical services workers. Aurora Fire Department paramedics Jeremy Cooper and Lieutenant Peter Chichuniak have pleaded not guilty. Initially, no one was charged because the coroner's office could not determine exactly how McLean died. But in 2021, social justice protests over the 2020 murder of George Floyd drew renewed attention to McLean's case, prompting an indictment against the paramedics and three officers. What we saw 3 years ago, that put a huge spotlight on the police profession, University of Miami criminologist Alex Piquero said, adding that the McLean case has the potential to do that for paramedics and first responders. Wolfberg said the thinking about such cases has changed, especially since George Floyd's death. Obviously, there are political considerations. That's not to deny Mr. McLean's family the justice they are seeking, he said. Defense attorneys at a November court hearing indicated they plan to blame police for McLean's death during a trial expected to last most of December. The defense attorneys did not return telephone calls or emails seeking comment on the charges the men face. Cases pending elsewhere include paramedics in Illinois facing first-degree murder charges after a patient they strapped face down to a stretcher suffocated, and an involuntary manslaughter charge against a nurse in California who continued to draw blood from an unresponsive patient while officers pinned him down. It's exceedingly rare for EMS providers to be charged criminally related to providing inpatient care, Wolfberg said. That is normally a medical malpractice issue, a negligent case which is civil, and it's really criminal. This breaks new ground. One of the police officers indicted in McLean's death was convicted last month of the lesser charges he faced, homicide and third-degree assault, after defense attorneys sought to blame the paramedics. Two other officers were acquitted by jurors following trials that lasted for weeks. Cooper and Sichuniak are charged with manslaughter, negligent homicide, and several counts each of assault, all felonies. Their role in McLean's death loomed large in the first officer's trials. Attorneys for one of the acquitted officers brought in a paid expert witness who were hired to work on the paramedics' case by state prosecutors. Dr. Nadia Iwowitz-Tereschenko, an emergency room doctor who has worked as a paramedic, said Cooper and Sichuniak's actions fell significantly below the level of care expected. She testified that the paramedics stood back watching McLean from a distance as he was restrained by police, did not examine him before the ketamine injection, and did not monitor him afterward. Prosecution experts also testified during the earlier trials that the ketamine ultimately caused McLean's death, with some saying the officer's violent stop set contributing events into motion. The amended coroner's report, issued in 2021, found McLean died because he was given too much ketamine. However, forensic pathologist Stephen Sinna noted the amount found in McLean's blood was within the range normally considered safe. McLean was stopped the night of August 24, 2019, while walking home from a convenience store, listening to music, and wearing a mask covering most of his face. The police stop quickly became physical after McLean, seemingly caught off guard, tried to keep walking. He was unarmed and had not been accused of committing any crime. He was rendered briefly unconscious by an officer using a neck hold, prompting police to call for paramedics while officers restrained him on the ground. Cooper and Sichuniak denied being told the neck hold had been applied, according to their indictment. Prior to the ketamine injection, they stood near McLean and didn't speak to him or ask him anything before diagnosing him within about 2 minutes with excited delirium. They had been trained to treat the condition, which allegedly makes people hyper-aggressive, the document said. Critics say the condition has been used to justify excessive force, and some doctors' groups reject excited delirium as a diagnosis. In McLean's case, prosecutors said the diagnosis was inaccurate because the paramedics didn't adequately assess his symptoms. A 2021 report by experts hired by Aurora to review McLean's death found he had not moved or made any sounds for more than a minute before being injected. Sichuniak, supervisor of the Aurora Fire Department's paramedics crew, asked medics working for a private ambulance on the scene to prepare the ketamine injection for McLean, the indictment said. Cooper injected him with 500 milligrams of ketamine, a dose appropriate for someone who weighed more than 200 pounds, according to the indictment. McLean weighed only 143 pounds. Before the ketamine injection, body camera footage shows Cooper asking police if McLean spoke English, and Officer Randy Rodema, the officer convicted in the case, responding, "He speaks English, but he's definitely on something." Prosecutors in Rodema's trial said using language like that, which suggested McLean had excited delirium, made the police officers complicit in the paramedics' decision to give McLean ketamine. 2 days after McLean's death, the Aurora officials put out a statement saying, "A standard medication routinely utilized to reduce agitation was administered to McLean and reduced the exhibited anxiety." The killings of McLean, Floyd, and others triggered a wave of legislation that put limits on the use of neck holds in more than two dozen states, including Colorado, which now also instructs paramedics not to give ketamine to people suspected of having excited delirium. The condition had been described in a since-withdrawn emergency physician's report as manifesting with symptoms including increased strength. Critics have called the diagnosis unscientific and rooted in racism. The city of Aurora agreed in 2021 to pay $15 million to settle a lawsuit brought by McLean's parents. Colorado, Biden to visit Denver, Pueblo during rescheduled trip by Lauren Pennington, The Denver Post. President Joe Biden has rescheduled his Colorado trip and will arrive in the state for a two-day visit today, marking his second trip to Colorado this year, the White House announced over the weekend. The trip, part of his administration's Investing in America tour, was originally scheduled for October 15th, but the visit was postponed just hours before departure so the president could attend national security meetings regarding the Israel-Hamas war. Biden is expected to participate in a campaign reception in Denver on Tuesday before heading down to Pueblo's CS Wind Factory Wednesday. The location of his originally planned visit in October and the largest wind tower manufacturer in the world. "We are thrilled to welcome President Joe Biden to Pueblo, the home of heroes and the best chili in the world, the Pueblo chili," Governor Jared Polis said in an emailed statement Monday. Colorado is leading the nation in transitioning to 100% renewable energy, and our wind manufacturing capabilities are helping to power our clean energy economy, create jobs, and save people money on electricity. We continue working to advance our goal of achieving 100% renewable energy in Colorado by 2040. In April, Polis joined CS Wind to celebrate the official groundbreaking of the new manufacturing plant in Pueblo, and in 2 days he will join Biden and his team on their visit, Polis said in a statement. During his Wednesday visit to the factory, Biden plans to deliver remarks on how his administration's economic policies are mobilizing investments in clean energy manufacturing and creating jobs across the country, particularly under the Inflation Reduction Act, the White House said in a statement. Biden's trip to Colorado this week will be his fifth visit to the state since taking office in 2021. In brief, police arrest 13-year-old boy in man's fatal stabbing. A 13-year-old boy was arrested on suspicion of second-degree murder by the Aurora Police Department after officers found a man with multiple stab wounds to his torso in South Aurora on Sunday night, according to a news release from the department. The man, identified as 40-year-old Dominic Robinson, was found by officers responding to a report of a stabbing at an apartment complex in the 16,000 block of East Easter Circle in South Aurora about 9 p.m. Sunday. Officers performed life-saving actions on Robinson until medical responders arrived and he was rushed to a hospital where he died of his injuries, the release said. The suspect was at the scene when officers arrived and was taken into custody. He is not being identified because of his age. State's Family Leave online portal open for applications. The Colorado Department of Labor and Employment's Family and Medical Leave Insurance Division's application portal for its new paid family and medical leave program is up and running, allowing employees to begin applying for benefits immediately. Additionally, the department in a news release announced 3 virtual town hall dates for Coloradans to learn more about the voter-approved program, which takes effect January 1st. The first event is on December 6th, the second on January 10th, and the third on February 1st. The town hall will be hosted in English from 11 a.m. to noon and then in Spanish from 3 to 4 p.m. on each date. Registration and streaming information can be found on the FAMLI.gov website. According to the announcement, the My Family Plus portal will allow employees to apply for partial wage replacement if they need to temporarily step away from their job due to a significant life event. These briefs were from Michael Braithwaite, the Denver Post. Pueblo lawsuit. Former officer shocked compliant woman by Katie Langford and Lauren Pennington, the Denver Post. A former Pueblo police officer who admitted to having anger issues and inadequate taser training was not disciplined or fired after an internal investigation found he may have used excessive force, according to a federal lawsuit filed this week. The lawsuit filed by 39-year-old Pueblo resident Christy Gonzalez alleges former officer Benny Villanueva shocked her with a taser in her back while she was getting on the ground and complying with police officers during an arrest. Gonzalez still experiences numbness and difficulty using her right hand as a result. The lawsuit also alleges Pueblo Police Chief Chris Noller did not train Villanueva or discipline him after an investigation by the department found he may have improperly used a taser against suspects on at least 2 occasions, including Gonzalez's arrest. Gonzalez and her attorneys are seeking monetary relief for the physical and mental damages, reimbursement for her medical and legal costs, to revoke Villanueva's state police certification, and to require the Pueblo Police Department to correct a state report that no officers had disqualifying incidents on the job, according to the lawsuit. Villanueva retired from the Pueblo Police Department on October 15th, according to spokesperson Sergeant Frank Ortega. Ortega said the department could not comment on the pending litigation. According to Colorado state law, Officer Villanueva should have been fired or at least decertified for a year, but Chief Noller didn't do that, Gonzalez's attorney Kevin Mayer said in a Monday news release. In fact, in his annual report to the Attorney General, he said that Villanueva had not been subject to a disqualifying incident. That's simply not true, and if he'd lied to the Attorney General to protect an aggressive and violent officer who disregards department policy and state law, then what else has he and this department covered up? The lawsuit centers on Gonzalez's encounter with police on February 21, 2022, when Villanueva and another officer approached her on suspicion of driving a stolen Toyota Tacoma, according to the lawsuit. Gonzalez had exited the truck, which had run out of gas, and was attempting to stop it from slowly drifting into a busy intersection, according to the lawsuit. Villanueva stopped the truck by pulling his police cruiser in front of the Tacoma. The body-worn camera footage provided by Gonzalez's attorney shows that after he stopped the truck, Villanueva jumped from his vehicle and said, "She's running," into his police radio, while Gonzalez stood nearby and began raising her hands in the air. When Villanueva drew his taser and shouted at Gonzalez to get on the ground, the other officer already had a hand on her, guiding her right arm behind her back for cuffs, the video shows. Villanueva grabbed Gonzalez's left arm with one hand and went behind her while still pointing his taser at Gonzalez with the other. Both officers had their hands on Gonzalez and she was lowering herself to the ground when Villanueva discharged his taser into her back near her spine, the video shows. The Pueblo County District Attorney's Office filed a complaint about Villanueva's excessive force with the Pueblo Police Department after receiving evidence about the incident, according to the lawsuit. A subsequent Pueblo Police Department internal investigation found that Villanueva may have violated department policies on conduct, including use of force, in Gonzalez's arrest and one other arrest involving a taser. The department's failure to discipline Villanueva for prior instances of excessive force by means of a taser, just as here, displayed a deliberate indifference on behalf of PPD in taking excessive force situations seriously and disregarded the risk to citizens at the hands of an officer who has displayed a clear pattern of excessive force, the lawsuit states. The lawsuit also alleges Villanueva was told to put together a training on use of force and tasers, but never finished putting the training together or presented it to other officers because he was told by a department official he didn't need to follow through. Villanueva told the department's internal affairs investigators he was angry about how the department handled the murder of his father, that he did his job as hard and as best he could and got punished for it. The expectation to be a perfect angel now under the 2020 police accountability law and lack of training in the department. Villanueva also said he was angry with his life in general and was afraid he was being singled out, according to the internal affairs report. Villanueva pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct in January 2022 in connection with an off-duty fight, according to the Pueblo Chieftain. Villanueva told internal affairs investigators he was falsely charged and the district attorney has some different feelings about me as an individual. Denver City Council, pro-Palestinian protesters shut down meeting. Two public hearings were postponed after demonstrators refused to cede podium, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators speaking out against the Global Conference for Israel coming to Denver this week took over the city council chamber on Monday night, causing the council to postpone the second half of its scheduled business until the next week. Members of the protest group, some waving Palestinian flags or wearing traditional scarves, implored council members to stay in the chamber and hear their concerns, but none did as the demonstration stretched on for nearly 2 hours. It's the third time in the last 2 years that activists have caused the council to go into recess by refusing to cede the podium after the 30-minute scheduled public comment period was over. It's the first time the council has adjourned a meeting because of such an action. It was just unclear how much longer the group was going to go, so I just didn't want to keep others waiting on some uncertainty, which is the reason behind the adjournment, said Council President Jamie Torres, who presides over council meetings as well as represents West Denver's District 3. She adjourned the meeting at roughly 6:50 p.m., an hour and 20 minutes after public comment was scheduled to end. A group waiting to accept a proclamation commemorating World AIDS Day and two groups seeking to rezone properties in North Denver were instructed to come back next week. More than 80 people signed up to speak during this week's public comment period, with almost all of them listing opposition to the Jewish National Fund USA as their reason for speaking. That group is the organizing body for the Global Conference for Israel, a four-day event that starts Thursday in Denver and will feature Governor Jared Polis, who is Jewish, as a speaker. Echoing talking points that pro-Palestinian demonstrators have been voicing in council comment sessions since August, speakers on Monday referred to the Jewish National Fund USA as an organization that raises money for the brutalization of Palestinians. One speaker, Abdul Karim Khan, compared the event to hosting a fundraiser for Nazi Germany. Sam Goldberg, president of the Jewish National Fund USA Mountain States, last week told the Denver Post that he expected reasonable and thoughtful critiques of Israel to be voiced at the conference, but added that anyone who supports Israel's destruction would be unwelcome. Pro-Palestinian and progressive groups are expected to protest the conference throughout, with the goal of shutting it down. Speakers on Monday also implored the council to pass a resolution supporting a permanent ceasefire in Israel's war in the Gaza Strip that began after Hamas carried out terrorist attacks on Israeli soil on October 7th. Torres said that the council has no legislative authority to dictate who rents the Colorado Convention Center, which is city-owned. There were Denver sheriffs and police officers in the chamber on Monday, but she never considered asking them to remove anyone. The council is reconsidering how it approaches its schedule and the public comment sessions specifically. Denver. Armed man shot by police after making threatening motion. The shooting occurred in the 800 block of South Oneida Street by Katie Langford, the Denver Post. Denver police shot an armed man they said refused to comply with commands after officers contacted him while he was taking trash from his truck to a dumpster in a parking lot. The shooting occurred in the 800 block of South Oneida Street on Monday afternoon, according to the Denver Police Department. Officers were returning to service from an unrelated call when they heard music blaring from a truck in a parking lot and saw a man walking back and forth between the truck and a dumpster to throw things away, Denver Police Chief Ron Thomas said at a news conference Monday. Denver police initially reported the shooting occurred during a traffic stop. Officers saw the man had a handgun tucked in his waistband at his back and began ordering to put his hands on his head, Thomas said. The man refused to comply with police commands and at one point made a threatening motion toward the gun at his back, Thomas said. Two officers fired their weapons and the man was hit in the upper body, Thomas said. Officers began rendering medical aid after the man went down and he was transported to the hospital. I believe the officers felt a threat and they responded to that threat. And I'm thankful this person is going to survive. But again, this is yet another instance where a person has a gun, and rather than following directions and dropping the gun or allowing the officers to safely recover that gun, decides to go for that gun and threaten officers with that gun, and it turns into an unfortunate result, Thomas said. The man is in critical condition and is in surgery, Thomas said, but is expected to survive. No officers were injured during the shooting. The shooting will be investigated by the department and outside agencies, and the findings will be turned over to the Denver District Attorney's Office. Denver police officers who are involved in a shooting are put on a modified non-patrol assignment and placed into a reintegration program, according to previous reporting. Cyber Monday, Biggest Day for Online Shopping, by Hallelujah Hedero, the Associated Press. Consumers are scouring the internet for online deals as they begin to cap off the five-day post-Thanksgiving shopping bonanza with Cyber Monday. Even though e-commerce is now part and parcel of our everyday lives and much of the holiday shopping season, Cyber Monday, a term coined back in 2005 by the National Retail Federation, continues to be the biggest online shopping day of the year, thanks to the deals and the hype the industry has created to fuel it. Adobe Analytics, which tracks online shopping, expected consumers to spend between $12 billion and $12.4 billion on Monday, making it the biggest online shopping day of all time. For several major retailers, the Cyber Monday sale is a days-long event that begins over the weekend. Amazon's, for example, kicked off on Saturday and runs through Monday. Target's two-day event began overnight on Sunday, while Arkansas-based Walmart kicked off its most recent discounts Sunday evening. Consumer spending for Cyber Week, the five major shopping days between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday, provides a strong indication of how much shoppers are willing to spend during the holiday season. Shoppers have been resilient this year in the face of stubbornly high inflation, which recently reached its lowest point in more than 2 years, yet remains painfully apparent in areas like auto and health insurance and some groceries like beef and bread. Economists, meanwhile, have cautioned strong spending is likely to wane in the coming months. Stressed consumers are relying on savings to fuel their shopping and are facing more pressure from credit card debt, which has been on the rise, along with delinquencies. They're also embracing buy now, pay later payment plans, which allow shoppers to make payments over time without, typically, charging interest. The National Retail Federation expects holiday shoppers to spend more this year than last year, but the pace of spending will slow, it said, growing 3% to 4% compared to 5.4% in 2022. A clear sense of consumer spending won't emerge until the government releases sales data for the holiday season, though preliminary data shows some good signs for the retail industry. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.